Hello, Emiliana Pena, and here I am at ACC 13 from San Francisco. These are our sessions, and I've taken the opportunity for my blog to talk to Dr. Michael Weber, a fellow New Yorker at this point, and I want to bring our audience back to basics, and that's what I want to call this talk today. We hear about all the new devices that are being tested for resistant hypertension, a problem that continues to trouble us. I see these patients on the side of heart failure very often having had hypertension mostly throughout their adult life and many times not treated aggressively, and they end up pretty sick in the hospital. We're seeing a whole group of heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, the HFpEF patients, many of whom have also had hypertension and have left ventricular hypertrophy and left atrial dilatation. And you wonder, where have we stopped thinking about blood pressure? In spite of all the new techniques and the new devices, what about just treating the patient? So I want to welcome Michael. Thank you for joining me today. It was a great opportunity that we're both here at ACC.
Exactly.
So do you think we have forgotten about the basics of hypertension and how to treat it?
To some extent we have, and I think it's partly because we are operating, many of us, in healthcare systems where speed is of the essence, where we don't have time to talk to patients, discuss lifestyle changes, the sorts of things that can certainly improve the treatment of hypertension. It's true most people will need medicines to get the blood pressure under control, but things to do with salt intake, to do with exercise.
And weight loss,
if you can get that done. Those are all worth talking about. Improving even the quality of the diet, the so-called DASH diet, the diet where you have more fruits and vegetables.
More grains and more fish, actually.
Exactly, yes. And of course, some of these strategies are not easy. Some of them are not even inexpensive.
Yeah.
That is an issue. But so it takes more skill to get them accomplished. We're not doing as good a job there as we might.
So do you still usually start with the non-pharmacologic, or if you have proven to yourself that somebody truly is hypertensive and not being treated, do you wait for them to try the non-pharmacologic approaches?
No, I don't, Ileana. I'm a big subscriber to the theory that your first shot is your best shot. And I will usually start with medicines and tell the patient, look, I'm giving you these medications because I believe they will get your blood pressure down fairly quickly. They're not going to cause a problem for you. You're going to be pleased with the results when we finally have the appropriate regimen for you. But if you can lose weight, if you can reduce salt, and we'll talk about how we're going to do that, if you can get yourself exercising, those sorts of things, we may be able to cut back on the medications.
That's a good carrot.
Exactly. Because if you do it the other way around, Ileana, if I say, lose weight, eat less salt, exercise,
doesn't happen,
and the blood pressure doesn't come down, now I start medicines, the patient thinks I'm punishing them. You didn't do a good job,
right.
So you're going to be punished. You've got to take these pills now. I'd much rather do it the other way around.
That's a very good point. So if you have, let's say, an uncomplicated patient, hypertension is confirmed, what drug do you start on?
Depends. If it's an African-American patient, someone of African ancestry, I would usually start with a calcium channel blocker. Most other people, I would usually start with either an angiotensin receptor blocker or an ACE inhibitor. And, of course, for those people who need two drugs, we'll all finish up in the same place, the ACE and the ARB, plus a calcium channel blocker.
When do you add the diuretic?
The diuretic could be added in place of the calcium channel blocker. And certainly if you need a third drug, it's got to be part of that trio. The reason I tend to favor calcium channel blockers over diuretics is twofold. First of all, we know from prescription data, which is fascinating way to learn about human behavior, that people prescribed a diuretic by itself as a first drug, the likelihood they're going to be refilling that prescription a year from now is about 20%.
Why do you think that is? Is it the cramps?
Could be cramps, could be perhaps increase frequency of urination. I have no idea.
That's very interesting.
Because in theory, a low dose of hydrochlorothiazide or even chlorothalidone shouldn't do much of that.
Patients
don't like it. But they do much better with calcium channel blockers. And, you know, the word gets out in the street or out in the community, whatever you want to say, that diuretics are really not comfortable drugs to take. Rightly or wrongly, people don't do well with
them.
What
about the combination drugs that you can give the calcium blocker with a diuretic?
That is fine, and I like a combination because that way the diuretic sort of gets in and its main side effects are being dealt with. My main reason for preferring calcium blockers to diuretics is we've now got a couple of major clinical outcomes trials where people do better, say, on amlodipine than they do on a diuretic in terms of strokes, heart attacks, fatal outcomes, and so forth. So I'm a big believer that the calcium channel blocker should be number one or number two in the regimen, not left for number three. So life is pretty simple as far as most people are concerned. By the time you have more difficult hypertension and you need two drugs, it's going to be either an ACE or an ARB plus a calcium channel blocker, could be a diuretic. By the time you need three drugs, it's going to be one of each of those.
One of each. And do you like once a day dosing or twice a day?
I do, Ileana. I like once a day. And all things being equal, I usually suggest that it be taken in the evening.
Really? Why?
Well, for a start, people, if they are going to get an excessive response, sometimes when a drug's at its maximum concentration, an hour later, you might feel a little bit of dizziness. If you take it at night, who cares? You're going to be asleep. You won't even notice.
That's right.
The other reason is I try very hard to persuade my patients to exercise, and most people like to exercise in the morning.
Right, right.
And then they ask me, should I take my blood pressure medicine before I exercise or after? And the truth is, I really don't know, because if I, say, take it before, it's possibly going to interfere with how well they can exercise.
And how well they feel, probably.
If I say afterwards, they're going to have this big blood pressure increase that comes when you have a good aerobic exercise, and they're sort of relatively unprotected because they haven't taken their medicine yet. Take it the night before, I don't have to deal with that problem.
That's a very interesting and I think a good hint for our audience on giving the drugs at night, which we don't think about it. We give a statin usually at night.
And as you know, Ileana, some of the big clinical trials that have used nighttime dosing, the HOPE study, which was for people at high cardiovascular risk with Ramipril, as you point out, the Ramipril was dosed at night, and they got very, very strong results in terms of cardiovascular protection.
Yeah.
And one of the definitive blood pressure trials, though HOPE was very much a blood pressure trial too.
Sure, it was.
But one of the big European blood pressure trials looking at people over the age of 60 with predominantly systolic hypertension, again, nighttime dosing was very, very effective and protective.
That's a very, very good trick. So when do you decide that the blood pressure is truly resistant?
The official definition is you have to be on three good drugs, the sort of regimen we've talked about, in a maximum dose.
At maximum doses. That's important because it's not a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
The only caveat I make, and there's actually a double caveat, there's no problem with a maximum dose of an angiotensin receptor blocker or an ACE inhibitor. There's no dose-dependent side effects. If you're on an ACE, you're going to cough. You're going to have it on
a
low or a high.
You're going to cough regardless.
Exactly.
That's right, yeah.
With amlodipine, which is the usual calcium channel blocker, at 10 milligrams, you are more likely to get edema.
The ankle swelling.
Do
you think the women get that more than the men?
Yes. Yeah. It is a much bigger complaint of women for two reasons. First of all, they tend to wear tighter shoes.
Sure.
Secondly, they're more likely to have their ankles exposed.
Right.
And thirdly, they're more aware of these things.
They're
more aware of their bodies.
The men may not be aware of that.
Yeah.
That's right.
So we often have to compromise on 5 rather than 10 of amlodipine. And yes, we say with a diuretic maximum dose is 25 milligrams.
Right. Do you ever go to 50?
I don't, but I could, and perhaps I even should, because 25 is not by any means
it's
the most powerful
dose
of either hydrochlorothiazide or chlorthalidone. Now, some people would say, forget hydrochlorothiazide. You should be using chlorthalidone.
Our pharmacists are encouraging us to use chlorthalidone because that's also where the data are.
Precisely. You're absolutely right. The SHEP trial was used in all HAT. It was used in the multiple risk factor intervention trial. So chlorthalidone does have good credentials. Mm-hmm. And 25 of chlorthalidone is
And it's not as expensive either. It's a little more expensive than hydrochlorothiazide.
Yes, it is.
But not by a huge amount.
Not by a huge amount. So that is very realistic. So we got 3 good drugs going.
Mm-hmm.
Blood pressure is still well above 140. Now, some doctors, some hypertension specialists would say, I'm still not giving up yet. I'm going to add a fourth drug, a fifth drug. Maybe I'm going to put in a beta blocker. Others would say, no, no, the drug you should be thinking about is an aldosterone antagonist, spironolactone, or if you have access to it, eplerenone. And those drugs do work well. The problem with spironolactone, as you well know, being a heart failure person, is that it does have symptoms.
Yeah.
And people, after a while, stop taking it. Not everyone.
Yeah.
And if you stay with a low dose, 25 milligrams.
Which is how we do it in heart failure. We stick with a low dose.
Yeah. So that can be very beneficial. But it's interesting, Ileana, people say, how often do you run into treatment-resistant hypertension? And it depends who you are. If you are a busy primary care physician, you would say it's about 10% of my hypertension cases. I got them on 3 or 4 drugs. They're still over where they need to be. If you talk to one of the real hypertension experts, they'd say, oh, no, it's nothing like 10%, maybe 1 or 2%.
Really small.
Yeah, maybe once or twice a year I'll have a patient who I can't control in a realistic way.
But it's not the norm.
That's not the norm. So I think when we talk about treatment-resistant hypertension, we have to look at what is actually out there in the community.
Well, what about other things like sleep apnea or the patient taking other over-the-counter drugs like the non-steroidals? We see this in heart failure.
Absolutely.
And you've got to get that history out of the patient.
You are so correct. The non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, some of the cold remedies, even some of the antihistamines, even some of the antidepressants.
Right.
It's a lot of drugs to think about and talk about to make sure that that's not the reason. Sleep apnea is difficult.
Yep.
And the reason is, no, a lot of people with sleep apnea have hypertension.
Right.
But most people with sleep apnea are obese. So
right.
Are they just, as it were, fellow travelers, concomitant conditions that not causing each other?
But if you have one and you have hypertension, doesn't the hypertension potentially get worse in the face of sleep apnea?
It very well might, and people show that people with sleep apnea have increased sympathetic drive forth. So, yes, there is a logical, at least mechanistic, connection between sleep apnea and hypertension. Even more aldosterone levels, all sorts of associations have been developed. So, yes, certainly dealing with sleep apnea would be a great thing to do.
At least asking the right question, and there are, for our audience, there are questionnaires that can be given to your patients in clinic that are very simple and ask questions like, do you know if you snore at night? Do you know if you wake up in the middle of the night? Do you have difficulty falling asleep? So that you get a sense if there's a sleep problem, you can start with getting a pulse oximetry at night. Simple. And there are companies that will come to the house and do that with a single, finger pulse ox.
No, I think that that's a great solution, much less intrusive and expensive than spending a night in a sleep lab. But I think all of these things have to be considered. And so you're absolutely right. Before we label someone as treatment-resistant hypertension, a lot of questions have to be explored. Sleep apnea is certainly one of them. The problem is that obesity is the sort of big looming issue.
And it's right here.
And we know that it's not easy to deal with. If it was, we would have done a much better job than we have.
And we haven't.
No.
We have. And the country is moving toward at least understanding that we have a problem. Obesity is a problem. It's a problem in children.
You know what, Ileana? If you do any hypertension trial these days, you suddenly realize that the average BMI of our patients is 32, 33. Obesity is the norm.
In heart failure, it's 30 when we did our exercise trial, so it's not that different. Mm-hmm. We don't have much time left, but I want to get a little bit to the denervation question. So we're seeing vagal stimulation for resistant hypertension. We're seeing renal denervation. Give me your thoughts on it briefly. What do you think?
Well, the first one you mentioned, the carotid baroreceptor stimulation, yes, it has the effect of reducing sympathetic activity and, as you point out, increasing parasympathetic vagal activity. Mm-hmm. It's very effective. And it's much more sophisticated than it was a few years ago. Mm-hmm. It's not yet approved for usual use, but mm-hmm. I think it is going to come. I think it's going to happen. And it'll be one alternative. Much more talk, as you point out, about renal denervation. And that has been spectacularly successful in people with very severe hypertension. People starting up in the 170s on maximum drugs, 5-6 drugs, by good doctors, so this is not contrived. Mm-hmm. We're seeing falls of 30, 40 millimeters of mercury.
What about the risks?
The risk seems relatively minimal, Liana. I worried about it. Mm-hmm. I thought, are we going to damage the kidney? Are we going to have salt-losing nephropathies? Are we going to have an inability to cope with stress because we're not going to have a renin angiotensin system? None of that has happened. Mm-hmm. The kidneys work fine. The blood pressure reduction, we now know, lasts for at least 2 years. That's
so
about
that's
as long.
That's where we have the data right now.
And that's
so
where we
years.
Have the data. Obviously,
We don't know
5 years yet. Mm-hmm. We won't know for another couple of years. But it's looking promising. It looks pretty safe. So I think it's a very legitimate procedure. What's important, though, is not to allow ourselves to forget, and you put it so beautifully at the beginning, the basics of treating hypertension and say, oh, you've got high blood pressure. I'm going to rush you off to an interventionalist and have your renal nerves ablated.
Because it's still an invasive procedure. Rather than pills.
Yes, exactly.
Which are and not cheap either if it ever gets approved.
No, it won't be cheap. I think it probably there'll be enough competition in that marketplace to have it as a reasonable alternative if you genuinely need it. I think it will be a very useful addition to our ability to treat these difficult patients.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining me today. This was a great discussion. I truly hope that this discussion helps you in your practices when you see the hypertensive patient and that you think about all the alternatives. We have an incredible armamentarium of drugs available, many of which are now generic and covered by the health plans. Make sure that what you order for your patient is covered by the health plan that they're on. Because otherwise, they will not get the drug unless they have to pay out of pocket. And out of pocket, the expenses get worse. This is often a population that has lower income. And with all the issues that we have right now with the economy, I always think of the patient's pocketbook as well. I leave you today from the ACC 13 here in San Francisco. Have a great day.